She loves it hot. He loves it cold. However you sleep, the pod by 8 Sleep adapts to you. Get up to $350 off with code DEEPSLEEP at 8sleep.com.
Looking for something smart, soulful, and full of heart? I'm Jen Hatmaker, host of For the Love, the podcast where we talk about what really matters. Love and family, faith and purpose. Every week, I'm joined by incredible guests for honest conversations that invite all of us to live with more intention, more laughter, and more connection. Join us on For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We dive into real-time true crime updates from Odyssey stations across the nation. This week, we're looking into what happens when violent criminals get parole, specifically how it impacts the communities they move into after their release. We'll also get a detailed rundown of a harrowing Uber drive that turned into a chase and ended in gunfire. We'll be ending the episode with some reflections on the late director Rob Reiner, 3 months after his murder. But to start off, we have some short updates on several other cases, starting with the latest on a missing flight attendant from reporter Austin York out of Odyssey Station KRLD 1080 in Dallas.
32-year-old Eric Molina, a North Texas resident, went missing last Saturday after a night out with a fellow flight attendant. The two visited a bar in Medellin, popular with international tourists. He hasn't been seen since. Fico Gutierrez, the mayor of Medellin, has announced a lifeless body was found between the municipalities of Jericho and Puente Iglesias during the search for Molina. He claims it's a very high probability that this is Molina. Colombian investigators believe Molina may have been drugged, and they claim to have identified the people he was last seen with, noting that all of them have criminal pasts. American Airlines says they are working with authorities and helping to support the family at this time.
KRLD also covered an update to the 1991 cold case murder of Cynthia Gonzalez in Arlington, Texas.
A woman who was arrested in a cold case murder in Tarrant County won't face charges after all.
25-year-old Cynthia Gonzalez was murdered in September of 1991, but for decades, no one was charged in the case. That changed last year when criminology students at UT Arlington reviewed the case as part of their coursework. They helped investigators ID 63-year-old Janie Perkins as a possible suspect. Investigators say she and Gonzalez had been dating the same person and that Perkins had told detectives that she was glad Gonzalez was dead. She was arrested last year on a charge of capital murder, but after the Tarrant County grand jury reviewed the case, they decided there was not enough evidence to issue an indictment, so the charges are being dropped.
For now, that case remains cold. In the Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago, Illinois, 18-year-old Sheridan Gorman, a first-year student at Loyola University, was fatally shot on March 19th while walking with her friends near the beach. 25-year-old Jose Medina has been arrested in the case. According to the Department of Homeland Security, Medina is from Venezuela, is living in the U.S. illegally, and has a criminal record. In a year of tension over illegal immigration crackdowns, Gorman's tragic death has become part of the political discourse. Here's Jeff Buckles with Odyssey Station WBBM News Radio in Chicago with more on the case this Friday.
The latest statements from the Gorman family acknowledge expressions of condolence this week from Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson.
There's no words that one could express that could properly console a family that lost their baby.
And Governor J.B. Pritzker.
The Gorman family has suffered mightily.
But they also reject both leaders' attempts to pivot to criticism of federal immigration policy or broader discussion about public safety. In the family's words, what happened to Sheridan cannot be reduced to a senseless tragedy. This was not random, it was not inevitable, and it cannot be treated as though it were. The family also references a statement made by local alderwoman Maria Haddon in response to a question about whether Sheridan Gorman's death was targeted. Again, this is a quote. Our daughter was not in the wrong place at the wrong time. The system failed her. Family members, friends, and others are set to hold a vigil in Sheridan Gorman's memory tomorrow in her hometown in upstate New York.
Another shooting described as not random was reported by Megan Lynch out of Odyssey station KMOX in St. Louis this week. That station reported on multiple developing crime investigations.
Police still looking for the person who shot a 13-year-old boy in St. Louis yesterday. St. Louis City Police say the boy was in surgery last night and is in critical but stable condition. Officials say the boy was shot after having a conversation with the shooter Tuesday afternoon. After multiple 911 calls were made, witnesses put the boy in their car and started driving him to the hospital. During the drive, they flagged down an ambulance, which then transported that teen the rest of the way. Police say they do not think the shooting was a random act of violence. Charges have been issued following a recent shooting that left two dead and three critically injured. St. Louis police say 26-year-old Luhizo Malin has been charged with first-degree murder following the death of a 21-year-old involved in the shooting. That shooting took place outside a smoke shop north of downtown St. Louis Saturday. Two of the men pronounced dead on the scene, the other three critical but stable. The police say Malin was the only person involved in that gunfire who was not shot. A Bridgeton pediatrician sentenced to 20 years in prison told a federal judge he's embarrassed and ashamed that his mother would be turning over in her grave. 70-year-old Craig Spiegel, convicted on multiple charges of prescribing tens of thousands of pills to at least two dozen women in exchange for sex, explicit photos, or cash. Prosecutors say he coerced women who were struggling with addiction. Some of the women were once his patients. Over the course of a decade, he wrote more than 1,200 illegal prescriptions and also defrauded Medicare and Medicaid.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
As we reach the end of a second month with no sign of where 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie is, her daughter, Today Show host Savannah Guthrie, sat down with Hoda Kotb this week to plead for her mother's return. Guthrie disappeared from her Arizona home on February 1st, and authorities believe she was kidnapped. Crime and terrorism analyst Brad Garrett joined Odyssey station WBEN in Buffalo this Wednesday to discuss where the case stands now.
So we continue to look into the Nancy Guthrie case. Savannah Guthrie once again pleading for the return of her mother. Brad, you know, at this point of an investigation like this, what does the actual investigation look like? You know, that heavy presence outside the home has gone away. A lot of the fervor around the search seems to have as well. What does it look like weeks after the fact?
So it doesn't, when the cameras and the headlines go away, Brent, it doesn't really change what the agents and detectives are doing day in and day out. I mean, you have sort of the following. My guess is they have leads that they're still working, like new leads. But the other thing they're going to be doing is going back and reviewing old leads to A, see if there's a connection between these various leads. Did they miss something in an interview, for example, a few days after Nancy disappeared that's now relevant to a new piece of information that if you put them together may give you some direction or at least somebody else to go interview. So it's sort of a constant of following leads, but also re-examining leads, re-examining the evidence. Did we do everything we could forensically, et cetera? And the other thing I used to do almost every week in an unsolved case is, am I looking the wrong direction? You know, there's a focus, whatever that focus is, I'm not sure, but let's say it's one particular direction. Does it make sense? Are we missing something? Should we be going in another direction? So all of those things are basically occurring, you know, in squad rooms and offices, et cetera, that the public isn't getting a daily dose of, like happened early on in this case. But, you know, they'll stay at it until they can figure out what happened.
You know, Brad, should we assume that there's no more video that has surfaced? Should we assume that they tracked all of the Ozark backpack purchases in Walmarts and came up empty? And should we assume that the DNA analysis is over, that genetic analysis?
I wouldn't assume any of those things. because we just don't know. The backpack, you know, if he paid cash for it, did they capture him on video? There are things that that could be potentially missed with that. For example, we haven't heard anything more about this quote-unquote unknown DNA. I'll tell you, without knowing, the answer is it can be difficult sometimes. Is there so little of it? Is it degraded some way to make it difficult to come up with a profile of that DNA? Maybe they have, maybe they haven't. But even if they have, I assume they've run it against CODIS, and that didn't take him anywhere. And so it doesn't really do you any good until you come up with a viable suspect, assuming that's even a bad guy's DNA. So there were all those unknowns. So speculating, I don't think, is going to be helpful because we just don't know. But clearly, they haven't arrested anybody, nor has there been any indicators, at least from the public's view, that they're on to a particular person. But we'll see. I mean, cases like this, you're one tip away from solving it. But obviously, that one tip hasn't come through the door yet.
Now, Brent, you've worked with families who have been in this situation before. It's got to be heartbreaking to talk with them. And, you know, in a case where something like this happens, I mean, we've all seen a family member who's up there in age pass away. And, you know, we have the ability to deal with that, internalize it, move on. But when something like this happens, how is it different than just, you know, saying goodbye the normal way?
Because it's completely outside your control. I think, Brian, one of the why this case, I mean, there's several reasons why it's so popular. Obviously, Savannah Guthrie, because of who she is, the millions of people know who she is, et cetera. That brings in one component as to why this may get the coverage it's gotten. But the real factor, I think, for the general public is the idea that one of your parents, elderly parents, is abducted, obviously harmed based on the blood that was at the front door. And now 2 months later, you feel like you can't do, there's nothing you can do about it. And so, you know, the guilt sets in, shame sets in, you know, what could I have done? You know, did I contribute to this some way? You know, not logical thoughts, but it's all the stuff that goes through. And I think it goes through a lot of people's heads that just watch this, like, oh my goodness, you know, I have an elderly mother, for example, that lives in X location, and this could happen to her, and there's really nothing I could do about it. So I think that's another factor as to why this case touches so many people.
You know, this many weeks later, do you think this was the Nancy Guthrie case? Do you think it was targeted or not?
Well, you would think so based on the facts of the following, that the video, the second video, this is just a still shot. They show us it clearly looks like the same guy standing outside her house. In that particular still shot, we don't know if he approached the house, but it's, that adds to the idea that he did some sort of surveillance, as clumsy as that would be. I mean, the last thing you'd want to do if you're doing surveillance is walk up to a front door that has a camera, but be that what it may. Was it targeted? I think the answer is yes. Was it a mistaken target? Don't know the answer to that yet. Did something horribly go wrong in this case? If it's in fact about money, maybe, since other than those ransom demands that came through emails, which I'm going to guess here, have no connection to the guy standing at the front door. But be that, what do we really have here? You know, is this personal for something in the background of a family member, of Nancy's background? Just don't know. But certainly directions I'd be looking if it were my case.
Things are moving ahead in the death penalty trial for Peyton Gendron, the white supremacist neo-Nazi shooter who killed 10 black people at a Buffalo Tops supermarket in 2022. Former Erie County District Attorney John Flynn joined WBEN to discuss how jury selection is going.
Jury questionnaires are going out soon in the federal death penalty case of the top shooter. John, this is the first in what looks like a very lengthy process toward finding 12 fair and impartial people.
Yes, Susan, and obviously it's the timeline's been moved up here because they want to make sure that they find 12 people who are fair and impartial and don't have any preconceived notions about this horrific murders. And obviously that's going to be tough to do. You know, this was a extremely well-publicized case. This was all over the media, not just here locally, but nationwide. And, you know, to find 12 people who don't know anything about it and who can be fair and impartial is going to be difficult. So the timelines have moved up, and the number of people that they want to include in their jury pool has been expanded as well. We're talking 3,000 questionnaires going out here by the end of March.
Yeah, 3,000 people, and they're hoping to get maybe half of those to qualify to move on to the next round of jury selection, which could be lengthy. These questionnaires, what types of things are typically asked on them?
Well, the first round, Brian, is just going to be general questions because they're going to automatically eliminate people. So like you said, the goal is they send out 3,000. They're hoping to get about 1,200 good ones. So they're figuring they got wiggle room here to eliminate automatically, 1,800 of these, automatically. Automatic disqualification are going to be anyone on active duty military service, any police officers, fire, public servants, non-citizens, people who are elderly, age will be a factor, people who can't read and write, people who are non-citizens, people who don't know English. You have just basic questions, how old are you? Where do you live? What's your occupation? Are you a U.S. citizen? Can you read and write? Can you understand English? Period. Simple questions to kind of weed out that first 1,800. So then, like you said, you hopefully get 1,200 who are, okay for next round. And then when you go, and then they're all going to show up, the 1,200 are going to go on a federal court anywhere between June 15th and June 26th. And then they're going to get a second questionnaire. And that second questionnaire is going to be more in the weeds. Questions like, what do you think of the death penalty? What's your role, if any, in the criminal justice system? Have you been arrested? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? They're going to get in much more detail with the questions on that second round questionnaire that they're going to get in June once the batch makes the first qualification.
There has also been contention over whether black jurors should serve on the jury due to the racially motivated nature of the case, Flynn said.
Have you ever felt like you were living just a B or B plus life? It's so dangerous to live that, more dangerous than a B minus or a C plus life, because when you're living a B or B plus life, you don't change it. You think it's good enough. Is it? I'm Susie Welch. I host a podcast called Becoming You. People think, okay, an A-plus life is not available to me, but there is a way. We are all in the process of becoming ourselves. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEN also reported on an update from Erie County regarding a shocking 1990 rape and murder case. The offender, Chad Campbell, has been granted parole, but few communities are willing to accept him as a resident.
In Palmyra, New York, back, was it August 1st of 1990, a then 14-year-old boy stabbed to death a 15-year-old babysitter, a female, and then raped her, and then killed a 17-month-old infant because the baby boy was crying too much. That individual was granted parole by the New York State Board of Parole, and lives in Erie County after having been turned down by some other jurisdictions. Joining us right now is a guy who says the murderer should not be living in Erie County.
Erie County legislator Frank Todaro joined WBEN to discuss the response from County Sheriff John Garcia.
This began last week when it came to the media, in regards to Sheriff Garcia, bringing it to the public's attention that he was not pleased to hear that, because he had no inkling or no warning whatsoever that this Chad Campbell was going to be residing here in Erie County. So I looked into it, and, you know, coming back to this, it's like, what is his connection with Erie County? I have so many questions. Why Erie County? Did someone allow, say, hey, come on down, we'll let you live here? Who did that? How did it happen? There's a lot of unanswered questions I got to, you know, get an answer for.
Well, the New York State Board of Parole can have up to 19 members. My understanding is it operates now with about 17 members. And as far as from where they come, there are two from Erie County, Joseph P. Krangel and somebody named, we've got Aaron McCabe of Erie County and a Laura L. Battiti of Erie County. Are you familiar with any of these people?
I've heard the names. I don't know them personally. You know, this board is, you know, when the laws change, they, you know, adapt to the new law that was, you know, entered last year of 2025, that anybody that was arrested and jailed as a youth has the ability to go before this board and be released. And that's what we have right now.
No matter how vicious or heinous the crime against however innocent the victim.
That's the issue here at hand. Yep.
So as an Erie County legislator, do you have any legal standing to have your voice heard, especially because we were told last week by the former Erie County DA John Flynn that the state parole board has jurisdiction over where released inmates may be situated?
Yeah, that is a fact there. The former DA is correct on that. But, you know, our honorable body has, you know, a voice of almost a million people here in Erie County. And that's our goal, is to bang the drum and tell them this is not acceptable and it needs to change.
Well, you know, one of the things we got into the other day was the idea that, you know, some crimes, do we really need to grant parole to everybody who applies, no matter how many times they've applied? Because some crimes, it seems, are so particularly heinous and inexcusable that they ought never to get out of an incarceration situation. And I think whether you were 14 years old or 21 years old, if you stabbed to death a 15-year-old girl and then a 17-month-old baby because the baby would not stop crying, I think it would seem to me and most people that a situation like that, you ought never to be back on the street again.
That's right. At 14 years of age when he committed this crime, I don't know how someone can do that crime and then go home, ride their bike home, change their clothes, take a shower, and then go and attend a sporting event like nothing happened. You don't lose that knack. I can't see that happening.
I can't even begin to grasp this. Now, without saying so on air, because I don't know what the legal ramifications might be, but as far as his living situation in Erie County, this will be a yes or no. Do you have any idea where he's living in Erie County?
I do not have not even a general inkling of what area he's in Erie County. I am told he is residing in Erie County at this moment.
And you want him out of Erie County?
Yeah, I mean, looking at it, like, what business does he have here, first of all? I'm told there's no direct family. You know, how does this happen where, you know, Wayne County spoke up, and that's where he, you know, grew up, was raised, and they spoke up, and they, I guess, seems like the parole board or the jail committee figured, you know what, let's call it the state, said, we'll just go where else he's invited to. Somebody had to allow this.
You think he'd feel... Well, when you say somebody had to allow it, do you believe that... do you have any reason to believe that the county executive, Mark Poloncarz, had a heads up where the sheriff, John Garcia, did not?
No, I wouldn't put a name to it, but I don't have any idea. There had to be some kind of conversation behind the scenes that said, you know what... we have no problem or issue, you know, we'll allow that here. That's one of the things that's on my mind. I'd like to get answered. A crime like that is just, this is not normal. We're starting to begin to normalize things like this. It's got to stop.
Well, on the other hand, let me play devil's advocate here for just a moment. According to the laws of New York State, This killer has paid his debt to society. According to the laws of New York State, or the way things are done in New York State, according to Hoyle, the parole board does have jurisdiction over where a released inmate is going to live and for how long that inmate is going to be under parole supervision. So in terms of the law itself, despite how wicked these acts were, committed when he was 14 years old, can we say that this killer has served his debt to society and we really don't have anything more to say about it?
No, I think we can just simply raise our voice and be heard. I mean, that is where that's where it starts. You got to push it to those listening and tell them this is not acceptable. We don't want it here. We don't allow it here. Making sure that the public is aware of what's going on, being fully transparent.
What was intended to be a simple trip to buy groceries became a terrifying chase through Prairie Village in Kansas in an Uber this week, according to reports. The incident ended in gunfire and a flipped vehicle. The Dana and Parks Show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City interviewed a reporter who covered the case to get the details this Friday.
Let's go straight to Krista Chatchell with KNBC 9 News, who did the interview with this survivor, Krista. And I'm so thankful you reached out to me because we kept saying, like, why were these men chasing the women? Did the women know each other? This woman was just in the back of an Uber.
I know. I hear a lot of bizarre stories, but this one kind of had my jaw on the floor when I was speaking to her last night. And we don't know yet. We don't know if she said, I didn't know the Uber driver. I did not know at first that we were being followed until my Uber driver said, I think we're being followed. We're going to go. They were going to a gas station, one of those kind of in an urban desert that has some grocery store items. So she was just going there like usual.
Yeah.
And they went to another gas station and then the chase was on. And there are so many things that I can't fit in, you know, to the minute 30 we get for our packages. But wow, no, police don't know. I spoke with Overland Park Police PIO John Lacey, and he said, we don't have any suspects yet. I asked him about this Uber driver. What do we know about her? I see, you know, it's so hard to know right now. It just seems like these guys, as they were described to me as two young males, and I said, were they men? And she said, no, they look like teenagers. And Tara Moore is her name, and she has kids. She has teenagers, so she would know. And she's a mom of four, and now she has five, you know, bullet wounds from her neck down to her foot. And she didn't even know that she had been shot until she was in the car that she was in, crashed after going over 100 miles an hour, crashed at Franklin Park, caught on fire. And then she looked down and she said, oh, I'm bleeding. And she didn't even know because her adrenaline was going so fast. I mean, it is bizarre.
And then Krista, in the middle of all that, a good Samaritan pulls her out at his own peril and saves her life.
Yeah, and if you've ever been to Franklin Park, and it was a pretty nice day on Sunday, so there were a lot of people at the park, and this was around 6, maybe 6:20 in the evening, and some people stepped in. She doesn't know who they are. She said that she thinks it was two people who dragged her out, dragged the Uber driver out. They called 911, and by this time, other 911 calls were coming in because people caught this on their Ring camera as they were speeding by. I mean, we have some of that video that we hear the gunfire going on, and it's a barrage. It's like, it's just this automatic weapon. It's terrifying. I mean, I can't imagine being the one in the back seat trying to think about how am I in this situation? I mean, they went all over. I sent you, you know, that picture of her Uber ride. and it was wild.
Well, Christy, you understand, I'm sure, as well as anybody, Dana does as well, so do I. TV and radio are brothers and sisters, but we're different. You only had a minute 30 last night. You've got another 5 to 6 minutes now. What would you want to tell regarding her story that you weren't able to include in your package last night?
But what I would want people to know is that right now, don't jump to conclusions. You know, we can all, I think it's very easy to be an armchair quarterback when you're sitting at home and you weren't in the car. I mean, I've had some weird Uber rides, not like this. I've had some friends who've had some dangerous Uber rides.
We all have.
I would just reserve your judgment on judging her or judging anyone else involved in this until all the facts come out.
You're talking about the driver, Krista.
I'm talking about the driver. I'm also talking about Tara. You know, I've already seen comments on our web stories of people who are unkind. And I would just say, hold your judgment until the police release all the facts. They're in the middle of this investigation. They will release it to us when they believe it's safe to release it to us. I honestly don't know their timelines all the time.
Have you, Krista, have you reached out to Uber? Is Uber aware?
Not. I'm sure they are, but I didn't have time to reach out to them today. My story is mainly about Tara and what she went through.
Okay.
That's for another day. And I, you know, John Lacey at Overland Park, he's a pretty great PIO, and he's usually pretty forthcoming. And he said, you know, this is ongoing information. This is an ongoing investigation, and we'll release it to you when we can. But if you drive down on 95th Street and you hit Row and you go north, you will see a dozen pink circles in the road. And they're in people's driveways too. That's where they were finding shell casings.
Oh my God.
And yesterday they shut down, I think it was from 99th to 95th or somewhere along there, to look for more. I mean, when you hear the audio there, I don't know how many shots were fired. There were so, so many. But I mean, if you drive that on Row going north off of 95th, the houses are so close to the road. They're so close to the road. And Franklin Park, I mean, it's all residential. And of course, it's rare for something that like this to happen in Prairie Village, but it can happen anywhere.
The other thing, Krista, police have the Jeep. Here's what I don't understand with the shooters. Mm-hmm. They have the Jeep with the Kansas plate 9103ACY, and they're asking for the public's help identifying the people or the car. Do you know, were the shooters in a stolen vehicle? They have the license plate number.
Yeah, I don't like to assume anything, but just as John Q. Public, that's me right now, I imagine it would probably have to be because they would already know registration,
VIN
number, things like that. So I don't know. Somebody, as we have seen, you guys are all news people too, as we have always seen, there is always an explanation behind something and eventually it will come out. But with Tara right now, the fact is she is a mom of four who now lost her job this week. She's a forklift driver and she works kind of temp forklift jobs in different warehouses around the city. And they called her yesterday. This is like a day after she gets out of the ICU and say, we are so sorry this happened to you. We want you to get well, but your contract's up.
Whoa.
So I'm not going to name that company.
No.
But she didn't even tell me she had a GoFundMe up. Like she did it for her kids and she didn't even tell me. I found it out later that was out there. And if anybody wants to donate, help her out a little bit. I mean, those medical bills are going to be astronomical. Anyone who has a doctor's visit knows how much it costs. So there's a GoFundMe link. It's on KNBC.com attached to my story. If anybody cares to donate or look into this further, I would just say, let the facts come out. And I imagine it's going to be wilder than we think.
It's my understanding, based on your reporting, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the speeds got up to over or near 100 miles per hour.
Yes, that's what Tara said. She said when they were still on the highway kind of going 470, 435, and even in residential areas, of course, they had to stop and start and swerve.
Yeah.
I mean, they went over medians and things like that.
Oh, God.
They did. Like that Price Chopper at 95th and Mission.
Yes.
They had to jump a median. They went through a gas station, almost clipping one of the buildings in that area.
I'm not unfamiliar with that neighborhood. The speed limit is 35 to 40, depending on where you are.
I know. And think about Sunday, though. It's not traffic like today on a Friday afternoon. It might be a little bit slower, but it is always busy. I'm always up and down Bannister and in that area. So it is a wild, wild story.
Well, I'm glad she's okay, and I'm so sorry that happened with respect to her job. But I, you know, it is one of the odder stories that we've seen. And not that they couldn't have ended up anywhere. I mean, I don't want to say crime never happens in Prairie Village. We know that's not true.
But sometimes it goes into Prairie Village.
To end where it did, and no one else was seriously hurt or killed, really, if you have to find a silver lining, is a miracle.
Yeah, and that's the first statement. When we did our call, the first thing I said to her, I said, you know you're a miracle, right? And she's a woman of faith. I mean, I'm a woman of faith. And she said, I know God has a purpose for this, and I hope I figure that out, what it is. Hmm.
Late last month, Nick Reiner pleaded not guilty to murder charges in the death of his parents, Hollywood power couple Rob and Michelle Reiner. He's accused of stabbing them to death at their home and then fleeing the scene. These murders leave the couple's daughter, Romy, and their older son, Jake, orphaned. Rob is also survived by his adopted daughter, Tracy Reiner, whose mother was Penny Marshall. Since the murders of Rob and Michelle last December, people who knew and worked with Rob, a legendary director, and Michelle, a producer who often worked alongside her husband, have discussed the couple's long-lasting impact. This week, actor Will Wheaton of Reiner's 1986 film Stand By Me joined Odyssey station KNX News in Los Angeles to talk about how he and other cast members from the coming-of-age classic have handled mourning Reiner.
You know, I would imagine that it has been a difficult time since the death of Rob Reiner. Has being with each other during this time, during this tour, been helpful with the grief and the healing from all this?
It really has. The three of us got together late last year to sort of do some test screenings of this Stand By Me live tour that we're on this year. And we had been together, the three of us, for 3 days and like really on a bus together between cities and reminiscing and remembering and reestablishing the relationships that we started 40 years ago. And in talking about the movie with each other and with audiences, we really spent a few days in 1985 with Rob Reiner and with River. And when we came back from that tour, just filled with the love and joy of all of these wonderful memories, Rob was killed. And I am so grateful that we had had those moments together before that, so closely before that, because it created a space for us to very naturally land in together. And we've really leaned on each other these last couple of months as we have worked through the grief of it.
What was it about him? I think I've heard you say before, he talked to you guys, even 12-year-olds, not at you.
He was lovely. He was such a wonderful man. He created a safe space for kids to just exist. He created a space where it was safe to take chances creatively and exist as actual kids doing things that kids naturally do. In my experience as an actor to that point, I was 12 when we did the movie. I had been working since I was 7. In my experience, directors just never talked to me like I was a person. Directors treated kids like we were stupid, like we were unreliable, like we were props that talked. And Rob spoke to us like we were people. He approached us as if we were actors and artists. When it was when he was directing us in scenes, he would come down and really like gently ask us questions about the scene. How do you feel about what's going on here? Well, when Chris says this, why do you think Gordy responds? However, he would ask us questions like that, and it got me thinking about the story that we were telling. And it just created this this wonderful creative space where we were free to really be artists. And I think it is one of the reasons that the movie endures. There's an honesty and a simplicity to it. And that's just all because of the space Rob created for us.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KRLD 1080 in Dallas, WBBM News Radio in Chicago, KMOX in St. Louis, WBEN News Talk in Buffalo, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, and KNX News out of Los Angeles. You can find these stations and shows on the Odyssey app. You can also get these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Emma Grade, host of Aspire with Emma Grade, a podcast where I sit down with people who don't just dream big, they build big. From culture-shaping voices like Mel Robbins to leaders redefining success like Tracy Ellis Ross to game-changing entrepreneurs like Mark Cuban, Aspire is about mindset, ambition, and doing the work that actually moves the needle. If you're ready to raise your standards and take charge about the life and career you're building, Aspire is where you start. Follow and listen to Aspire with me, Emma Grade, an Odyssey podcast available wherever you get your podcasts.